So Ian Black, I live at the moment just outside Cambridge in that home of horse racing, Newmarket, and we'll be moving back into Cambridge shortly. So we're just sort of transitioning at the moment. I've lived here for, that's interesting. No one's ever asked me that question. Must be well over 20 years now. I moved into the area on joining a small and relatively unknown UK startup, software startup in Cambridge, called Autonomy. Now, if you ever Google that name, together with the word fraud, you'll find out exactly who I am, because at the moment I'm in the middle of the UK's largest corporate fraud. So it has nothing to do with this call. But that's how I came to be in Cambridge, with a company that ultimately got sold for 11 billion. I then have sort of been in technology now for over 30 years, and started to sort of see this emerging roots of control, as I call it, in terms of what the local council here recommended to everybody to be able to solve congestion. And I saw a group of individuals, and just so that I make sure that I hand credit to where credit is due, you should be looking at that group now in the top left-hand side of your screen, who are a great bunch of people who got together, residents in Cambridge, to say, wait a minute, is charging us for using our cars the only way of solving congestion? And of course, they and I would contest that it's not. So I've joined that group back in 2022, latter half of 2022.
Just so what are they called?
The Cambridge Residents Group, CRG, Cambridge Residents Group. And they're all wearing their brilliant looking T-shirts there, no congestion charge. And they got together to push back on a consultation, which is, of course, the modern word that's used for enslavement, a consultation with the local population on being able to resolve a problem that they described, they being the council, described as transforming the bus network. And if you look at my document that's on the right-hand side of the screen, the top three points there are the alleged objectives of the consultation to transform the existing bus network to be able to recommend a sustainable travel zone. Very carefully chosen words there, and I'm sure we'll talk about that later. But you'll see that at the end of that sentence, such as better walking and cycling links. So there's quite a few modes of transport left out of that sentence for the creative reader. And then it goes on to say that what this consultation was going to present was a proposal for charging vehicles. So well ahead of the consultation's results, it had already been decided that the best way to solve this problem would be to charge vehicles for driving within the zone, and I'm reading now from the original consultation document, between 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. on weekdays, and using money raised to fund improvements to the bus network and other sustainable travel schemes. The document you're looking at on the right is a document that we put together and went to the local ombudsman with, but that's another story. But the slide that you're looking at is really an introduction to the group, an introduction to the challenge that the group was set up to be able to face down, and an invitation to anyone who's watching or listening that if you want a copy of the document, which we might refer to once or twice whilst we're talking, Tony, please feel free to contact us on the emails below, camconcharge@gmail.com, or mail me, ian@ianblack.net, and I'll be more than happy to give you a free copy of it, because what that document does is really step you through what it was that Cambridge Council had already decided to do, and use the word, well, let's consult with the public. So their document in the top right hand corner of your screen, Making Connections, was a piece of artwork worthy of the Mona Lisa or alongside it, in terms of telling the population that really the only way to solve congestion was to charge car drivers. So I'll pause there for a moment, Tony, just to see whether you're still there or whether I've put you to sleep.
No. Well, this is not sleepy at all, because just share something with you as an experience when I was training in journalism back in 1988, I think it was, in London. I was there was something called the East London River Crossing that they were planning. I was working at this little station, Thamesmead Radio, and it was set up by the GLC, in fact, funded by the GLC for many years. And I think it was funded from charities for a few years before it finally got privatized and sold off. Anyway, I was treated to an off-the-record briefing by a chap called Jim Bode, who was the Deputy Permanent Secretary at the Department of Transport, who was, I mean, a little bit, I think they were a bit annoyed that they were this little radio station, that they didn't really know who they were, but they were chit-chatting to the locals about this East London River crossing. The idea was to have another, which it never happened, I think it was around the Greenwich area, to have another road going across London, a massive bridge, and it was going to plough through a lot of green space, particularly on the south of the river. And so there was a massive objections to this, and they ended up doing other things like having extended tunnels, the bridge, obviously at Dartford, the extra bridge they built eventually.
Yeah.
But as part of that briefing, I remember him saying very clearly that what they really wanted to do was something called road pricing. And I didn't really know what that was. And I was thinking in the back of my mind, well, there's already road tax, there's already fuel duty. The idea really, he seemed to, you know, this is 88. They wanted to have cameras around the country where when people decided to drive on a piece of road, they were charged per mile. And I remember thinking at the time, this is this is just a toll system. Now, the tolls, one of the reasons, for example, we had an English Civil War, you know, things like this, that people do not want to pay tolls. And actually, of course, if you had a consultation in Cambridge saying, would you like, you know, a daily £10 toll to use Cambridge's roads, they would get 99.9% people refusing it. But of course, if you say, you sort of pepper this thing with the word sustainable, etc., you're going to get a different point of view. So I just wonder what you make of the, you know, because obviously there's layers of agendas. We're just being lied to by our councils. We were lied to here in Bristol about the desperate need, you know, the legal desperate need to have a clean air zone. And we're now getting it's just a revenue stream, essentially, for to replace the money which is not being paid to local government from central government. So what do you make of that sort of rather in a nutshell analysis of what the government's really been up to, which is lying, you know, lying about just wanting to introduce tolls?
Yeah, I mean, you're spot on. It is a lie, because we all pay duties, we all pay tax, and we pay for MOTs and Lord knows how many other things over the years. And you know, you see it from the moment that these things start to surface. If you look at the bottom right of the screen, you've got this wonderful title, How to Take Part and Have Your Say. But this document's already declared, the red words on the left, that we're going to be charging vehicles. So really, you're having your say exactly what you're describing there, Tony. You're having your say about a decision that's already been made. So it starts off with the premise of a lie, and it just gets worse from there. My approach to this, and the group's approach to this, was first of all, you're not dealing with people in councils that are generally the smartest on the block. And if you start to dig into the sort of document that we were looking at previously, the first step is to always analyse and fact check what's being told to you. And it won't take you very long to be able to spot the holes, because there's normally a profound lack of thinking with all of these things, because in their minds, they've already made the decision. The consultation is, in their minds, something that's going to allow you to say, you know, how much you want to support it, not whether you're going to support it or not. So what you've got here is a consultation that kicked off on the 17th of October. Let's think about the time of the year that that is, and concluded on Christmas Eve. Now, how many people at that point in the year are going to have the time to dig through, you know, a couple of hundred pages and be able to assess for themselves what this consultation is actually recommending? Point number one.
Well, just, yeah, okay, just to reiterate that, here in Bristol, we had a massive debacle in January, actually, because the consultation had been taking place in the few weeks in the run-up to Christmas, but the allotment holders didn't know it was taking place. And it was only published about 2 or 3 weeks before Christmas, even though the date of publication, once it was had been published, was sometime in October or September. They kept it from the public for such a long time. The idea was that everyone will be so busy during Christmas and the New Year that there were, anyway, the allotmenteers got wise to it and they started to campaign massively in January. But this is, it's a little bit cheeky, isn't it? This is a way of pretending to be a democracy. And of course, the other thing is that the councils are a bit wary about judicial review. So they want to at least have had a semblance of some kind of consultation, because they know that a decision like this, if it's not a democratic decision, can be taken to court by the population afterwards. So it seems a little bit cynical. But anyway, look, can you get to, I mean, you've started on the road there, but how did you, get round to challenging and even maybe overturning what Cambridge Council were up to?
Well, let me step through that as quickly as possible, and you can stop me when you get bored. First of all, analyse and fact check. This is an illustration of one of the pages that's telling us 121 of our dear neighbours have died, because you'd assume from the graphic that the carbon monoxide, which obviously is toxic, is killing 121. If you dig through the details that I won't take you through on this call, lest I really bore you, you begin to discover that, of course, it isn't 121 deaths at all. It's in a completely different geographic area, not just Cambridge, etc., etc. So the lies just continually keep coming. And when you really start to analyse, and this is the problem, because the average person is too busy trying to run their lives to start to get into this sort of horrendous mess. But just look at the difference between all air quality. You'll see that in every consultation that's apparently killing us, though it's never been better for the last 100 years. You begin to see the differences here between what happens post-COVID. As time goes by, the air gets cleaner. People are walking less, so why are we charging car drivers for them to walk more? And the air pollution, look at this, which was, 21%, is actually now 41% less than it was before COVID. So the problem with all of these approaches is that the people putting these consultations together aren't very smart. They've gone round to local businesses and tried to survey them. And again, won't read out verbatim some of the feedback that you're looking at on screen. But a lot of local businesses said congestion charging is going to kill us. You can't carry a plumber's equipment on a bus. You can't get, my mum, who's 98 years old, on a bus to go and do her shopping. So you've got an enormous amount of feedback from this consultation from local businesses saying this isn't going to work. What do they do with the feedback? They bury it. So the next point to answer your question, what do? Start complaining with the facts that you've gathered from these people's own data. And that's relatively simple, because they won't have checked the data themselves. I was told by one of these councillors, well, you can't question modellers, can you? Well, yes, actually, I've been questioning modellers all my life. And I've generally found them to be, two pennies short of a pound. So always start to complain. And I'm not going to bore you with the content of this. We came up with sort of half a dozen complaints that started to spell out, well, what is it that's actually wrong with A, your data, B, your suggestion? Where are the other options that you've considered? Well, of course, they don't exist, because no one considered another option, because they were convinced that everyone was going to vote for congestion charging. And start complaining. And then from that, step three, start creating and initiating news. We use local rags to be able to start to take votes. 91% of people who voted didn't want the thing. We start to use freedom of information requests, discover all sorts of interesting things going on in the council, which they decided not to release to the public, that FOIs are really quite effective at being able to get. We started to create a brand and a look that people would identify with, and very simple messaging that said, what is it that we're going to do? And of course, what we started to do immediately was then organize some sort of a very public event in the form of what you're looking at here, a march that got up to about 6,000 people, and started to create headlines that spread the message. And here's a key point. because the consultation only got to less than a couple of percent of the population they were meant to be consulting, most people had no clue what this thing was. So what you've got to get to is newsworthy events that capture attention and start to draw in people who are trying to live their lives and not have to fight some bureaucrat who's come up with some crazy idea that the general population don't want to support. And you can see some of the headlines here that we started to garner through local publications, Cambridge Live in this particular case. We also started to get to a point where support started to wobble. Now, what you discover here is that, of course, in these councils, they've been elected on the quiet because most people aren't interested in electing council members, and birds of a feather flock together. You'll discover that those birds of a feather aren't always perfectly aligned. So what your newsworthy events are starting to do is discover that there's a difference between the council members themselves. Start to exploit that. We set up a website. We started to do some social media in terms of going around and interviewing the local population who have the most fantastic examples of why the congestion charge will never work. From, you know, my mum who's 98 to a young mother who's got children to get to school. You get to the real stories of why these ideas are madness to begin with. And then you begin to question, well, who the heck would come up with them in the first place? And more importantly, why? That's exploiting the weak link. And here's the challenge. Most of us think that to be able to stop these things, we need vast numbers of people. We don't. You'll remember that little picture I showed you at the beginning of the Cambridge residents group. It was really a handful of people, six or seven people, who decided to take action. And if you go through those two or three, four steps I'm showing you now, you can really find the weak spots and start to pressure on them. And it's surprising how quickly things start to fall apart. In this particular case, as this headline shows, somebody who'd just been appointed to a prominent position in the council decided the heat was just too much. The objections coming from the general population grew in ferocity, in noise, were being communicated across all social media platforms and had started to be picked up nationally. And surprise, surprise, a very strong Labour area of Cambridge called King's Hedges voted in a Tory member because the Tory member supported dumping the congestion charge. So very quickly, what I'm trying to say is you don't need a lot of people. You do need some time to be able to exploit the weak, find and exploit the weak links in other people's arguments, the council's argument. And you'll quickly find people like Delaware, whose picture is here. He's a taxi driver. He's a taxi driver in Cambridge who decided he'd had enough and he would stand up in a Labour stronghold. And this is how we did it. A little leaflet overlay here, King's Hedges by-election. I got out on the doors with my colleagues in the CRG and we went knocked doors. Here's something else I learned doing that. Politicians don't know their audiences anymore. They used to when you and I grew up. No more. They're careerists. They're not really interested in the local population. They just want to be elected to hold power and spend money. And don't we know it in many other areas of life? So once we got out and knocked doors, I would typically be confronted with a Labour supporter who'd say, A, I didn't know about this. B, what do you mean there's going to be a toll at the end of my road? You mean I've got to go and spend X amount of money, £5, £10, or God forbid you own a lorry, by the way, that's £50, to just go shopping. And you get to a point in the conversation in less than 60, 90 seconds where they'd say, I can't vote Tory. And hey, I have every sympathy in the world with that particular position. I don't support any of them. But they'd say, well, I can't vote Tory. What do I do? Simple. Don't vote. Let us send a strong message to these people who think that they can just keep taxing you, that times are a-changing. And enough Labour voters in King's Hedges, a Labour stronghold, didn't vote. As a result, a Tory taxi driver got into position. I've never seen more panic break out in an elected force like a council and local MPs than when that happened. that really was us then beginning to roll at significant speed, and the whole thing started to fall apart. But we didn't finish there. We'd now got enough speed to be able to get national attention, and that's effectively the stage that we're at now, where we're combining with other authorities and other groups throughout the UK who've suffered in the same way that you have and are in Bristol, and we're starting to combine forces. So we're really now, I think, at a point in history when we've learned how to take these people on and beat them at their own game. And their own game is to get into power. And the minute that you exploit that weak link, you'll find that they scatter like the cowards that many of them are.
Well, you're describing something, I think you used the expression yourself, exploiting the weak. Now, this is once that's exposed, that's what these people are up to. I mean, this is actually painting a rather dark picture of the way that British politics has changed over the last 40 or 50 years.
Well, when else in our living history did some oink called the Prime Minister decide that they wouldn't vote on something in Parliament? They'd just start to decide what the rules were themselves. It's absolutely incredible what's gone on in the last 4 years. And it's no wonder now that we've got a long list of things, from COVID to the Ukraine to Trump to vaccines to low traffic neighbourhoods to 20 mile an hour zones, where people are starting to say, wait a minute, are these things connected? Is there some global conspiracy going on? So, no surprise then that I think people are beginning to wake up and ask, well, who's really in control? Is this really a democracy? And if it isn't, then who's running the show?
Well, that's my next question. What do you think, if you take a step back from all of this, this is not the only thing that people are being subjected to in Britain, which is totally anti-democratic. It's the opposite of what they want. And so what do you think is driving this? I mean, we've got cameras going up everywhere. I worry, actually, about surveillance. And I remember probably in the 90s, reading a book by Edwin Black called IBM and the Holocaust, which was all about the surveillance of the German population in the 1930s.
Yeah.
Looking at this massive data collection that had been going on by the Germans of everybody's addresses, their ages, their religions and all this sort of thing, put into these IBM punch card machines by the Nazis. Which, by the way, the IBM in the United States was making quite a lot of money hiring these machines out to them. So this idea of data collection and data theft could have a sinister agenda. In fact, if you look at what's going on now, we need to be aware, I think, that this could be abused, all this data that's being collected from our... I mean, the idea here is, with these cameras following cars around, for example, obviously there's similar sorts of things going on with facial recognition cameras, is that somebody with that database and access to it, whoever that is, could know far more about you than you know about yourself. They know where you were on a certain date last year. You know what? If someone asked me, I'd find it impossible to tell you, but they know.
Oh, absolutely. The only thing I sort of disagree with that you've just talked around there is that we are moving into that society. Sadly, we're not. We're already in it. And I speak with at least some experience because, as I referenced at the beginning with my introduction, I worked for a UK software startup that was, for the want of a simple explanation, really beginning to put together the first form of artificial intelligence. This was 20 plus years ago. Artificial intelligence isn't that new, by the way. Intelligence agencies have been using it for decades. And if you go back through organizations or newspapers like The Guardian, you'll find plenty of references to the way that that information was being stored 25 years ago. Now, of course, we know that the storage of information about our personal lives is done in broad daylight in terms of organizations like Facebook and Google. And unless you really know your stuff, it's too late. Everything about you is already known. And to your point, more known than you know, because there's a perfect memory there of where you were using Google Maps and who it was you were communicating using your Vodafone, et cetera, et cetera. We don't need all of those explanations again. And the story has got to a point where we no longer know where that information is. we no longer know who's policing it, but we know damn well that we're not, and that we're not controlling it. So I don't think it's a conspiracy theory to look at areas like China, where, you know, if you cross a zebra crossing at the wrong point, a picture's taken of you and your social credit score is docked. That's not conspiracy theory. That's fact. And if you really start to do your digging into some of these councils and organizations that we now have in the UK, you'll discover that many of these people are far left of left, openly communist, and very open about the way that that society should be run. I mean, they're unabashed in terms of telling us that that's where they'd like to go themselves. They feel
well, look, hang on. Communist, maybe. Fascist, there doesn't seem to be all that much difference here. The idea is that there's a plan and the people aren't part of it.
Well, you know, we're getting to a point in the conversation where I could veer left here. And we've only spoken once very briefly while I was driving a car and we were arranging this call. What I never sort of suggested to you was that if you step back from all of this, you're bound to come to a conclusion that there is something much bigger going on. And I would use the word evil. I believe in good. I believe in evil. I'll use a word that will immediately polarize some members of your audience. I'll use the word spiritual. I think there's a spiritual act going on that is evil. It's lack, which is what evil means, by the way. It's taking away the rights of people whilst trying to convince them that they're giving something in return. And there's nothing being given in return. There is definitely a force of evil at work. And if you think that's conspiracy and over the top, then just look at all of the legal complaints that have been made about the current ruling party at this stage in March 2024, and how much each of them have made in their own pockets from COVID, from lockdown, from supporting you know, organizations that have profited from supplying the NHS. That's evil. And the fact that it's going on such a grand scale is to me more than just man on his own coming up with plans to line his own pocket. There's something on a much wider, unseen and invisible scale that's taking place, which is linking these things together. Sound conspiratorial to you? Perhaps. But have you actually gone away and looked at the evidence?
Well, yeah. I mean, for example, our mayor here in Bristol, he was tapped up at a young age. Somebody said, you're going to be a leader. He then was taken over to Yale University. He's a Yale World Fellow, where he shared a accommodation block with Alexei Navalny, who's recently died over in a Russian jail. Very strange. He just on the eve of the Munich Security Conference. So very handy for the West to say, oh, the Russians have killed him. But the point here is that there seems to be a sort of tapping up going on of our leaders rather than us saying, well, this is the kind of person we want. And there's not a lot of choice in the matter. Look, I mean, this is a World Economic Forum. It's a big, big player here in Bristol. The group of cities, I think, is in it 30 cities, which Mayor Khan is chair of. These organizations now seem to be far more powerful than our elected politicians.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I would just bring in another facet here, because I think we could disappear down 100 rabbit holes, and maybe that's where you want to go and your audience is interested in. I think there's a sort of very clever trick being played, and I've fallen down the hole myself, so let me just be transparent. You can get so upset and angry about this that, yeah, you take to the streets. I'm very happy to take to the streets and fight a congestion charge. I think I'm obligated to do so for the sake of my children and grandchildren. But at the same time, the trick is to turn us against each other. And that's the bigger problem I think we've got to discuss and start to recognize. It's that old psychology trick, you know, that prisoner dilemma. Who do you turn to and who do you turn against for survival? We can't turn against each other. So whilst I have, you know, strong views about the current ruling political party, I have strong views about all the political parties. When I see Parliament completely empty, when there's a very valid debate going on around the data around COVID, but I'm getting to the stage where I recognize that that trick of turning against my fellow man is part of what's being orchestrated at a higher plane. So I've been down the line, certainly when we were all locked down, of screaming obscenities at the TV screen. You know, when somebody dares to suggest they're going to take away my liberty and they have no law or legal right to do so. But I've got to the point now that a lot of recognizing that if I'm not careful, I cross a line where I just become part of the problem. I think we've got to be careful of that, Tony, because I'm not suggesting that we lay down our weapons of warfare in terms of raising each other's awareness and acting. No, absolutely. I'll be fighting the congestion charge for the rest of time. But I think at the same time, I'm recognizing that a lot of my fellow men who want to just get on with their lives peacefully, let's face it, most of us just want peace. Most of us want to live happy lives. We don't want to be wasting time having to rediscover ourselves in a brave new world. We just want to live. I'm recognizing that by getting out and meeting my fellow man and talking about the problem can be just as effective as screaming about the problem. So, you know, for me, I'm kind of crossing the Rubicon now of screaming at the TV screen and feeling that just by shouting louder, I'm going to get more progress, and recognizing that there are more of us than them. But if they trick us into fighting each other, then we will most definitely lose and the minority will win. And it is a tiny minority.
Yeah. No, I think I've always understood, I think, that, for example, war, like what's going on now in Gaza at the moment in March 2024, an absolutely horrific, quite obvious genocide taking place with the people of Gaza hemmed in and being starved in a siege, as well as being bombed from the air. So this kind of thing, as you said, is evil. This is evil we're witnessing. Actually identifying who's behind it, they're also sort of smoke and mirrors to try and discover that and uncover it. I would suggest we're looking here at a sort of fascist international and Zionist elite, financial elite. I've been studying for a long time, studying the Bilderbergers and their operations in order to try to control politics. But I think until we understand this spiritual aspect, that we've got to identify those who we do get along with, people who we can. And actually what you've done, I suppose, is so fascinating, is galvanizing resistance to bad ideas, what you've done in Cambridge. So look, can we just round off, because this is a really important thing to be able to actually meet people and be activists on the ground to fight back against these confidence tricks against the public. Can you just finally round up by explaining how people can get hold of the sort of presentation that you've just given, get hold of the tactics that you've used, and maybe in completely different separate campaigns replicate the same sort of thing?
Yeah, sure. I mean, these are the steps that I went through in the presentation, and they're very simple, but they do require some focus, and it does take time to sort of focus your mind, find out what the party that you have a odd feeling isn't quite representing you as they should be, have said in detail. Dig down. Don't necessarily believe what everybody else says around you. You know, Tony, I grew up in what I would call an extreme form of religion. And I make the distinction because there is a God, there is a Jesus Christ, but religion does something completely opposite to what Christ taught. So don't just groupthink. Don't sit in the back pew and think everybody else has worked it out for you. Analyze, fact check, and come to a stable conclusion. Complain with clarity. There's a lot of things you can get involved with and shout about, but actually there's very few people who can articulate them in very few words. So get clear in your own mind what you're objecting to and why. Use the news against itself. We've all heard the term fake news, but actually fake news is just another term of trying to get us into groups. You know, I would even take issue with the word Zionist, because that will mean completely different things to completely different groups. It'll upset some and mobilize others. We're talking about our fellow man in both sides of the border in Israel and Gaza. And we're being set up to fight each other. Nobody wants to see people unnecessarily exploited, but I'm very happy to exploit weak links in things that are evil, my step number four. If you get those four things right, you will have a disproportionate effect. Number five, repeat, which is what we're doing now by trying to talk together, find out where we're common, find out where we're different. Nothing wrong with being different, but discover those things with sense and don't be blindly led by what it is that you see on the BBC. My gosh, the good days of the BBC are gone. Sorry, I know you used to be there once, Dave.
Well, no, hang on. Actually, last week's BBC Question Time was terrific. They had brilliant discussion. Oh, see, you weren't watching, were you?
There you go.
Terrific. I mean, it does happen sometimes. We had Melanie Phillips, who's very pro-Israel, sparring with Ian Black from the SNP, who wants a ceasefire. Very, very good, as well as a brilliant discussion about this Hester guy who's given a $15 million donation to the Tory party after building up on NHS contracts a £1 billion company himself. So he's given them a tiny bung of his profits, and no one really was really talking about the fact that he was someone who'd profiteered off the back of the public and one of the people who's been sucking money out of the NHS. But anyhow, I mean, it does sometimes do the job. And also, of course, the opposition is people like Murdoch and the private television companies. So the BBC still has got its role. The World Service isn't too bad. And every now and again, you get a fantastic documentary on there from time to time. So, you know, without the BBC, I think we'd end up in a literally sort of fascistic, with a fascistic TV system, very much like the sort of thing they had many years in Colombia, you know, where it's only private interest that will get a hearing. Anyhow, I don't mind people having a dig at the BBC at all. But look, just whereabouts, just remind us, Ian, whereabouts to get that information. If people want to get in touch with you, how do they do that?
Yeah, let me go back to that slide that will put it up on screen, and I'll read it out slowly for those who are only listening. So my address is ian@ianblack.net. Group that's featured on the slide I've got up at the moment is canconcharge@gmail.com. And, you know, we're happy to team up, find out where our commonalities are, find out where our differences are, and, you know, go forward together arm in arm.
Okay, Ian Black in Cambridge or just outside. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for the opportunity.